There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Want your most burning finance and investing questions answered? Here's a podcast you should be listening to, courtesy of Acast Recommends.
Are you ready for some personality in your personal finances? Hi, I'm Janice Torres Rodriguez, Latina money expert and host of the award-winning podcast, Yo Quiero Dinero. On this show, we're serving up POC-friendly personal finance knowledge, always with a side of sass. We're not talking about avocado toast and lattes on this show. We've got real, relatable personal finance knowledge that makes you feel seen, heard, and finally understood. Consider me your super cool, slightly risque, but always honest financial fairy godmother. Together, we'll tackle dinero in a fresh new way so you can finally become poderosa with your dinero. Check out our weekly podcast episodes at YoQuieroDineroPodcast.com or subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Histories of the Unexpected.
He's the famous historical adventurer Dr. Sam Willis.
And he is Professor Extraordinaire of Early Modern British History at Plymouth University. He is Professor James Daybell. Hello, James.
Hello, Sam. How are you today?
I'm very good.
Good.
Now, Histories of the Unexpected is the show that demonstrates how everything has a history, even the most unexpected of subjects, and that everything links together in unexpected ways.
Who knew, for example, the history of furniture? The history of furniture was, in fact, all about hiding, persecution, social control, and the invention of comfort. Or that the history of the smile is about none other than Charles Darwin, electrocution, the French Revolution, and the history of smugness.
Oh, that's good.
The smug smile.
The smug smile. I mean, if you want to know more about that, you'd have to come to see us live.
Are we live at the moment,
Sam? In our live show, on our tour.
Good.
Today, we are doing the history of eyes, which is... It's a classic unexpected subject, because when you said, let's do eyes, I said, what? I said, I don't know what you're talking about. How can eyes have a history? But of course they do. So let's just do our usual thing and start off the top of our heads, just thinking about the history of eyes and see where we end up.
You start with eyes.
Well, you know, let's just...
Where I start with eyes, and thinking about it in this historical brainstorm, is with my poor eyesight.
Ah.
And if I lived, I think I would be dead by now if I lived in former times, because I am so blind.
I didn't know that.
I literally could. Oh, I am so blind.
Short-sighted.
So short-sighted that I would literally, like, we are sitting here probably about a metre and a half away from each other, and I have no idea, I would have no idea who you were looking at you. Over there. And so for me, it's about eyesight across the ages and the invention of spectacles. I mean, there are early examples of spectacles going back to about the 12th, 13th century, people using corrective lenses. But I imagine that the history of mass glasses use is relatively new.
Yeah. But I've had laser eye surgery.
You've had laser eye surgery.
Yeah, which is it's weirdly linked to my present and my past and my future.
Oh, are you going to have it again then?
So I was short-sighted, but I've had one of my eyes corrected.
Right.
Which means my left eye has remained short-sighted and my right eye now is slightly long-sighted.
Oh, so did they not do a good job then?
They did it on purpose so that I don't need reading glasses when I'm older. So at the moment, I'm slightly short-sighted.
Goodness
and
me.
My eyes corrected and sort it out. And in the future... When my eyes change and I would, in theory, need reading glasses, my long-sighted eye will dominate and allow me to read. So I have, neither of my eyes is right, but my vision together is quite good. It was the most painful thing I've ever had done.
I bet it was. I hate pain.
They shaved the front of my eyeball off, is the way they described it. So there are different ways you could have it done. And, yeah. So eye surgery is one.
Seeing the anatomy of the eye, the biology of the eye, I imagine, is another way.
Accidents as well. I had an accident. We have a podcast on accidents, which is one of my favourites.
Yes.
But eyes and accidents is obviously very interesting. I didn't have a direct accident in my eye. I hit my head. I fell off a ladder and landed on my head. And had a huge egg of, like a big bruise of gathering of blood in the middle of my forehead, which then drained down and gave me two black eyes, which basically almost closed both of my eyes, so I couldn't see. So it was sort of an accidental thing. But it's the experience of people throughout the ages of having accidents to their eyes or to their facial area, which would be interesting as well. Obviously, there's the ability of being able to see.
Yes.
And throughout history, you can take any event... Not any event, but an event which has affected a significant number of people, and there will be a blind or partially sighted history of that event.
Yes,
if you can find the sources, if you can find them, that's one of the great things. Another one for deafness as well. I'm doing some stuff on Hiroshima. Weirdly, there are people now trying to find the testimonies of people who couldn't hear the bomb.
Brilliant.
It is brilliant, isn't it?
Brilliant.
So their experience of it and the way they wrote it down and the way they recorded the atomic bombing, it's fundamentally different from people who could hear.
So it's the idea of an eyewitness account, almost.
It's a non-eyewitness account.
Or a non-eyewitness account.
In this respect. But they'll be blind, partially sighted. Go back to eyes quickly. They'll be blind or partially sighted historical accounts of particular events, and often those... accounts are hidden somewhere, aren't they? It's not like you can go to the National Archives and go to the blind or partially sighted account section, because there isn't one.
No.
So it's more difficult to find, which means we are behind in the history of those people and their testimonies, because we haven't found them yet.
Yes.
But there are people now that are out there actively looking to find out who was blind, who was partially sighted at all of these events.
And how they experienced
it. How they experienced it.
Yeah,
it's cool, isn't it?
It's very cool. I think there's also a way that you can take that in another direction. If you're looking at take it back to your starting point was a historical event, and the idea of eyewitnesses for historical events, so people who were actually there and saw it, and also the idea that you're not going to get a total vision of something. And Mark Bloch talks about this in his book The Historian's Craft, where he talks about the concept of the battlefield. And if you are trying to, as a historian, recreate the battlefield, there is no way you are ever going to be able to do that, because constantly different people's perspectives are very different, and that people in different parts on the battlefield have different views. Reports from them may not survive.
Yeah. And then that applied to land battles as well as sea battles, obviously, especially sea battles if you're fighting over an area of sea that's 15 miles by 15 miles.
Yes.
And it's not just... eyewitness testimony, although that's a crucial part of it, it's command capability as well. So you can't expect people to know and control things minutely if they don't know what they can't even see, and they've got no way of knowing what is going on. And I think one of the most important lessons you can learn, certainly as a maritime and naval historian, if you're writing about battles, is that the eyewitness testimonies, by definition, are flawed. Because they don't know what's happening elsewhere. They don't know why certain things are happening. And often they try and explain things according to one reason. And that reason is wrong, because they don't know about X, Y, and Z happening.
Tunnel vision.
That idea of tunnel visions just reminded me of something. When I was, I must have been 19, I was living in Paris, and I was invited to go to a masked ball. And being deliberately difficult, I decided not to wear a mask, but I wore some goggles. And I went to an amazing flea market in the north of Paris. It's a bit like Camden Market. And I found this amazing pair of goggles. I got them from a military shop. And they're not like goggles you can see through. Well, at least when you wear them, it looks like they're solid. But if you put them on, they've got these tiny slits that are sort of angled down one way and another. And so it looks like you can't see anything, but you can actually see brilliantly. And when I was wearing them at the ball, someone came up to me and said, "Why are you wearing some Second World War pilot's goggles?" I had no idea. So there's got to be a history here of optical enhancement that's not to do
with... I've got some here.
Not to do with lenses, have you?
Look at these. Were they anything like that?
Yes, very similar. Very similar. And can you see the little slits?
RAF Militaria. Yes, I can.
RAF,
fantastic.
RAF goggles. So yes. there is definitely a history of optical enhancement. Well, it's like tunnel vision, but tunnel vision.
Actual tunnel vision, yeah. Okay, so my starting point for eyes is in relation to another book that we're writing on the history of the Tudors.
Yes.
So it is the histories of the unexpected concept applied to the Tudors. And rather than it being all about Henry VIII, Elizabeth I, Mary Tudor, Edward VI, six wives, blah, 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 what we thought was that we would do it in an unexpected way. So the Tudors is all about eyes, accidents, what else have we done?
Shares,
shrinking, all sorts of things. And so for me, the Tudors is all about eyes, which is all about surveillance. I mean, those of you who love the Tudors, I can understand why. As a professor of Tudor history, I can absolutely understand why. Fabulous figures. But one of the things that you may not know is that this is not a totalitarian state, because unlike 20th century dictatorships, they certainly don't have the resources and power to eavesdrop in the way that Stalinist Russia or Nazi Germany did. But nonetheless, there is a surveillance state in place, and people's thoughts and deeds were observed. And you only need to look at that famous painting, the rainbow portrait of Elizabeth I, that hangs at Hatfield House, which is the home of the Cecils, the Earls of Salisbury. And it bears the motto, which translated in Italian, "No rainbow without the sun." And the idea is that it's about the power and wisdom of the Queen to uphold peace. And it depicts her literally holding a rainbow. Mm. And if you have a look at her dress, the sleeves of her dress, and actually the body of the dress itself, they're decorated with tiny embroidered eyes and ears.
I'm just looking at it now, and it's like one of those creepy 3D pictures where, you know, you stare at it and stare at it, and you suddenly see what you're supposed to be looking at. This one, they look like kind of folds in the silk, and then you realise they're eyes, and there are, we count them up, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13.
God. Lots of eyes.
They're like 20.
Imagine
that's the whole point, isn't it? It's a bit creepy. They're once you notice them, they're absolutely everywhere.
Imagine painting that.
Yeah.
So this represents the all-seeing and all-hearing power of the monarch, of Elizabeth I. Those of you who are familiar with your Tudor history and have read things like the book on the Elizabethan secret services, Stephen Alford's brilliant book on the Watchers, will know that Walsingham and his crew had tentacles everywhere. There were people spying. And I'll read you an example from a letter from the Cambridge scholar Matthias Holmes in 1596. And he writes to the Earl of Essex. The Earl of Essex is one of the leading statesmen at the time, the favourite of Elizabeth I. And Holmes writes to him sort of saying, "Oh, isn't it wonderful, your fame abroad and favour with the Queen?" But then warns him to be careful to take foreign intelligences, since all men's eyes are upon you now at home and abroad, and your eyes must be upon all men, spying out home treasons and foreign plots. So there's this complete idea of distrust. And I think it's because the Tudor period with the Reformation has suddenly set things alight, and there are different factions and different people. There are tensions in Europe, and there are statutes passed, there are acts passed through Parliament that prosecute people for seditious thoughts and words. And one of my favourite is from it's after the divorce between Henry VIII and Catherine of Aragon, and this is a period when Henry is trying to assert his power. His power as the head of the state, but also head of the church, and people are around in the alehouses and, you know, are listening to what people are saying and then reporting on them. It's a bit like Big Brother. And this is one poor woman who named Margaret Chancellor, who in 1534 called Henry VIII's new wife Anne Boleyn a, and I quote, "a naughty whore and a goggle-eyed whore," and saying, "God save Queen Catherine." And in her defence, she basically says, "I was drunk. The evil spirit did cause me to speak." And she was very penitent. And, you know, whether she meant these words or not, what it suggests, though, is that, you know, is that there is an undercurrent of criticism about the Tudor monarchy, and people would be punished for seditious speech like this, for political gossip, for criticizing one's social superiors. And there were all sorts of barbaric punishments that would be inflicted on them. So nailing, for example, ripping, cropping, and chopping off people's ears.
What does nailing involve?
Nailing. You just nail, you hammer nails through somebody's ears.
Oh, I see. Right. Yes. Okay.
Slitting the nostrils.
Oh, God.
Branding the cheeks and forehead with the letters F and A, which stands for false accuser. Boring holes through tongues with hot iron. And on rare occasion, putting out somebody's eyes.
Oh, I see.
So literally,
stopping
somebody's eyes.
It does make you think that you can do the history of tongues, ears, and foreheads.
Yes, and branding.
And branding. I think branding would be part of it all, wouldn't it?
Yeah. There's a Salman Rushdie short story where he describes people in India and a father who has lots of children and decides that one of the best career options for his young son is actually to blind him. So that he can be a beggar,
yeah,
and can make money for the family by begging, and he uses a little hot iron and pokes it in his eyes.
That's the same plot device of Slumdog Millionaire.
It is
the beginning.
Yes.
I wonder which one that came from. I bet it came from the Salman Rushdie book.
I bet it came from the Salman Rushdie book. The idea is that you put acid in people's eyes and then you poke it with a stick.
Yeah,
and.
So the Slumdog Millionaire, it starts off with a kid being blinded.
Yes.
The principle being that if you can sing beautifully and you're blind, you get more money.
Goodness me, it's about rackets.
We've suddenly gone to a dark place.
We have. Let's go away from that.
Okay.
Back to goggles.
Do you want to go back to goggles? I can actually go somewhere quite happy, actually.
Oh, good.
Is the idea of...
No, we like happy.
Because we're doing Vikings as well. At the same time, we're doing Tudors.
Yes.
And I've been looking at various kind of literary devices which were used in the sagas to describe people. And before we get to eyes, we'll just quickly mention foreheads because we're there at the time. But they had a kind of way of an established way of describing people to suggest whether they were trustworthy or untrustworthy or violent. There's a great one from Egil's saga here. We meet Egil Skallagrimsson, who's a bit of a rogue. And the author really revels in his appearance. Egil had very distinctive features with a wide forehead. His beard grew over a long, broad part of his face, and his chin and entire jaw were very broad. He had a thick neck and broad shoulders, was prematurely bald, and had a harsh-looking face. Now, interestingly, a lot of these physical descriptions are things which have been identified by modern scientists as being associated with high testosterone levels. And the pattern is very visible in the sagas of baddies, of particularly violent, roguish, unpleasant, untrustworthy, difficult people sharing a lot of these physical features. And there's a certain belief that the Vikings had a kind of an understanding of physiognomy, which was the medieval European science. They believed it was a science anyway, which associated your... We've actually talked about this before, haven't we? But not in relation to Vikings, but associated your appearance your behavioural characteristics. In which this case, it was ruffians. And you know, the broader point here is that it was something that might have been passed down through Viking society so that people could identify trouble coming.
Yeah, but people also, with big, thick foreheads.
Yeah, big beards and harsh-looking faces. And
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for for you.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
But there's another aspect as well where in the sagas, eyes are really, really important. They're seen as also sort of a window into unsavoury personalities as well as nice personalities. And we have descriptions here of people being bright-eyed or happy-eyed, which is something we'd associate with. But we also have here a beautiful but dangerous woman who's described as having thief's eyes. And other examples, you have people who are fierce-eyed, darting-eyed, or sour-eyed. And not quite the same as goggle-eyed, whatever. No. It's a weird thing. The goggle-eyed whore description, that means
like eyes bulging. Out, like bulging, sort of, and sort of eyes that move around.
Is it a, do you think it's a around. Physical description physical. Of someone he's... Like she's describing to be goggle-eyed in the Tudor period is a way of describing someone who is ugly or has wonky eyes or bulging
it's a,
eyes.
Wonky eyes. It's a roving and bulging eye. Or like a sort of... Imagine like a frog's eye.
Yeah.
Sort of popping out. And those ideas of eyes connected to character also connect to eyes being windows of... people's souls.
Yep.
So you can see somebody's personality and that. Exactly the same, that kind of eyes as an index of people were used in the Elizabethan period. So alongside some of the evidence that I've been talking about already, people would, so if somebody had shifty eyes, you know, presumably a Jesuit priest sort of, you know, bound on assassination, or if somebody was particularly penitent, so particularly humble, the tear-filled eyes were exactly the opposite. You know, that you showed that you're desperately sorry. Yeah. Whenever I'm in trouble, I often cry and instantly forgiven.
So it's the eyes as ways of communicating.
Eyes as communication. Well, part. I mean that is about eyes as communication, but it's also about it's about reading people's eyes.
That's interesting, isn't it? Eye contact.
Yes.
I'm going to just move away quickly from people's eyes to objects' eyes.
Objects' eyes?
Objects' eyes, which is a phrase I've just invented.
Excellent.
Ships have eyes, and ships had eyes. So
periscopes?
I was not thinking about that at all, but that's really interesting, because you could do the history of periscopes, the history of looking at sea, and you can do history of telescopes and nighttime telescopes.
And you could do World War One. You know those little periscopes they popped over there?
Yeah. And how you actually see and how you look and how it works
I'm going to buy my daughter, my youngest daughter, a periscope.
Oh, right, okay.
There's a little spy periscope that you can get.
Yeah.
She's obsessed with spies and it means she can look round corners.
Oh, yeah. Looking around corners good. Anyway, so the maritime sphere is an important area for eyes, but one of the things that has been discovered, and these are really, really from really old shipwrecks. So we're talking about 450 BC, currently the time that Herodotus was about writing history.
The grandfather of history.
Grandfather of history.
Yes.
Athenian warships, they found on wreck sites things which they now understand are eyes. They are actually eyes of the ship. So they're...
painted on?
Well, like you get a kind of... They look like a marble disc with a hole in it for a nail. And the nail is hammered through, and those marble discs are decoration which go on the hull, and they are literally the eyes of the ship.
Huh.
So the ship has
symbolic eyes.
The ship has physical, yes, but they are. If you pick it up out of the water now, that artifact is an eye of a ship.
Wow.
So it's a physical artifact as well as it opens up the world of trying to understand the metaphorical artifacts, the metaphorical point of why ships might have had eyes back in ancient Greece. But it's not just in ancient Greece. It's also to do with figureheads on 18th century warships. You know, those remarkable sort of carved figures, which have a weird appearance. And they often have goggle eye. They are often goggle-eyed, like Anne Boleyn. They often have bulging eyes. And the idea behind this is that the ship actually could see... It made the ship a living thing.
Yeah.
An eye being something that was so kind of consciously... associated with living and existing. The eye is open as opposed to the eye being shut or the eye being glazed. And it allowed the ship to the sailors were almost helping the ship find its way. It looked, it could look out for you. It could protect you. It was alert. It's absolutely fascinating. And there's a collection of ship's eyes. So you can go, if you go to various museums, especially shipwreck museums in Turkey, it's very often that they've found a ship. They've also found the eyes of the ship. And they're circular discs. They're about the size of a dinner plate, and they've got a hole in the middle for a lead spike.
Goodness me. Those ship's figureheads, fascinating. I had a tour around the new, it's called the Box in Plymouth, and it's the new museum. It's the museum and library, and they've had this huge HLF, Heritage Lottery Fund grant. They've turned it into this amazing space, which is going to house all the archives from the city and the museum all in one place. And they have built this incredible structure on the back. The Box is basically because it's on the back and it's like this hanging glass archive. But then they've got this wonderful mezzanine level and they're going to hang all the ship's heads there. So you imagine 3 ton of ship's head, like just suspended from the ceiling.
I reckon there's a really interesting history of ship's figureheads to be written. So I know at the moment, there are a couple of kind of pamphlets and they're just like, they changed from this to this and they were made out of this type of wood. Then, but no one's actually thought about why on earth there might be figures who are Native Americans, or there might be dogs, or there might be women. And if they're women, why do they look like that? How that changed, who was doing it, who made them, why it was made. There's an amazing cultural history of figureheads, which no one's
written. Very, very visual as well.
Very visual.
Stunning.
There's a wonderful collection down in Devonport.
Yeah. Those are the ones that are going.
Oh, I see, right.
Yeah.
But someone needs to do it, and they need to work out why, and why they were coloured. We did a podcast on colour. Why some are coloured and why some aren't.
The Vasa has wonderful decorations like that as well.
It's also to do with naming ships as well. So you might have a ship called the Benbow, and that was named after the famous Admiral Benbow. But then you might have a ship called Boxer or something, when you've got some admiral who's responsible for naming ships, and he named them all after his dogs.
Fido.
Yeah, but there was
Rex.
It's really important and interesting, and particularly because ships travel all over the world, and they meet different cultures, and they get inspired by different people, and they pick up different artisans from wherever they go, different artists. So there's like an amazing international cultural history of cultural exchange, which is visible in shipwreck figureheads. I'm just going to stop doing this. I'm going back to university. I'm going to write a PhD on ship figureheads.
I think you should. That would be brilliant. Putting out of eyes. I want to go back to that.
Yeah.
One of the most famous examples of this, those of you who know your Shakespeare, is in King Lear. And the Duke of Gloucester has his eyes put out. And it's this awful scene where the king's daughters, Goneril and Regan, these are the two nasty ones, rather than Cordelia, who's the lovely one. Lear's sort of gone off, and his loyal man, Gloucester, is basically accused of treason by the daughters. And there's a scene in, I think it's Act 3, Scene 7, where basically they put out his eyes. Mm. And I'm just going to read you this. So Gloucester comes in, and then Regan says, "Ingrateful fox, 'tis he." Then another man, Cornwall, says, "Bind fast his corky arms. What mean your graces? Good my friends, consider you are my guests. Do me no foul play, friends." And Cornwall says, "Bind him, I say." And then Regan calls him, "Hard, hard, oh filthy traitor." And it goes on and on like this. Regan plucks his beard, which I thought you'd be interested in. For, mm-hmm. We should have talked about that with our... plucking somebody's beard is a way of totally insulting them. And then they go on sort of insulting him. And questioning about his treason. And then they say, why have you sent him to Dover? Wherefore to Dover, sir? And then Gloucester replies, "Because I would not see thy cruel nails pluck out his poor old eyes, nor thy fierce sister in his anointed flesh stick boorish fangs. The sea with such a storm as his bare head in hell-black night endured would have buoyed up and quenched the stelled fires. Yet poor old heart, he holped the heavens to rain. If wolves had at thy gate howled that stern time, thou shouldst have said, 'Good porter, turn the key.' All cruels else subscribed, but I shall see the winged vengeance overtake such children." And this, I mean...
makes you wonder what's going on in Shakespeare's head.
The wrong thing to say, pluck out his old eyes, because then they see that his eyes are plucked out. First they take one eye out, then his servant comes along and tries to help him. The servant is stabbed in the back. Mm-hmm. And then they say that that Regan says, one of the daughters says, one side will mock the other because he's only got one eye, a sort of bleeding sort of gape. And I will pluck out the other two and the other eye comes out. And when you see this on stage, it is incredible. I've seen several examples, the most powerful of which, Gloucester is in a chair with his back to the audience, and the two, and so what you effectively see is the eyes of the people who are doing the gouging looking right at you, and then it's sort of, I mean, it's obviously not quite like that, but it's pulled out, and then the bloodied eye is thrown aside.
Gosh.
And there are actual accounts of this happening at the time. 1589, there's an account by Francis Walsingham from the Elizabethan ambassador in Constantinople, Edward Barton. He writes of a Greek friar who was caught preaching Christianity to the Turks, who condemned him to an agonizing death, which involved having his eyes pulled out. And it just to paraphrase it, he was raised up by cord and pulley and dropped upon a sharp iron hook and left there to hang, still preaching while he's being tortured in this way, until his angry punishers then cut out his tongue. They cut off his nose, his ears and fingers, and finally they put out his eyes, finally stoning him to death. And he survived this ordeal, we are told, for some 5 hours.
Wow.
What about that? Where are you going to go with eyes? I've got one more.
All right, go on then.
One more, which is very quickly, which is lover's eyes, which is Elizabeth I and the Earl of Leicester.
Yes.
And it relates to one of the final letters that Leicester wrote. Leicester was one of Elizabeth's favourites, Robert Dudley, from those of you in her early life. She was supposed to be infatuated with him. Before he dies, he writes her a letter, and she called him, her nickname for him was The Eyes. And if you have a look at this letter, over the O's, the double O's, he does little eyelids. And if you have a look here, you can see he signs himself by your most faithful and most obedient, and then eyes. And if you have a look at the most has the little eyelids over it.
Yeah. Clever, huh?
Very clever.
Why would he do that?
It's a secret code explaining his love and affection for the Queen.
Hmm. It's interesting. So we started this off by saying that the Tudors were all about eyes. And it's not, the point is, it's not just us as historians saying it was all about eyes.
They are all about eyes.
It really is all about eyes. Yes. And the image of the eye, whether it's in Elizabeth's dress in the rainbow portrait or it's in that letter there, those are just a few of the examples. It's a kind of a visual trope that they keep coming back to, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, I thought that was fascinating.
I should listen to it on my daily commute.
Amazing. If you've enjoyed that, we did, do please check us out online, historiesoftheunexpected.com. You can find us on Twitter, you can find us on Facebook, you can find us on
Instagram, YouTube, everywhere. Flickr.
Everywhere.
Twitter?
Yeah, loads of live shows. Hopefully there are still some left as and when you listen to this podcast. If not, check out our book. It's called Histories of the Unexpected.
How Everything Has a History.
It's available everywhere, and we're very, very proud of it. It's awesome. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening. Bye.
Bye, guys.
Do you ever feel like your brain is on overdrive and your mind is constantly racing? The plans, worries, and to-do lists are never ending. Calm can help your mind take a break from the noise by softening anxiety symptoms in the moment and helping you cope with day-to-day stressors. Calm is the number one app for sleep and meditation, giving you the power to calm your mind and change your life. Their meditations range to fit your needs each day, from anxiety and stress, relaxation and focus, to building habits and taking care of your physical well-being. They even have expert-led talks on topics such as tips for overcoming stress and anxiety, handling grief, improving self-esteem, caring for relationships, and more. For listeners of the show, Calm is offering an exclusive offer of 40% off a Calm premium subscription at calm.com/stressless. Go to calm.com/stressless for 40% off unlimited access to Calm's entire library. That's calm.com/stressless.
Want your most burning finance and investing questions answered? Here's a podcast you should be listening to, courtesy of Acast Recommends.
Are you ready for some personality in your personal finances? Hi, I'm Janice Torres Rodriguez, Latina money expert and host of the award-winning podcast, Yo Quiero Dinero. On this show, we're serving up POC-friendly personal finance knowledge, always with a side of sass. We're not talking about avocado toast and lattes on this show. We've got real, relatable personal finance knowledge that makes you feel seen, heard, and finally understood. Consider me your super cool, slightly risque, but always honest financial fairy godmother. Together, we'll tackle dinero in a fresh new way so you can finally become poderosa with your dinero. Check out our weekly podcast episodes at YoQuieroDineroPodcast.com or subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.